Greetings to the crew of the Gaia Navigation Experiment, to friends and allies scattered across time and space, and anyone else who cares to listen. It is September 23rd, 2012, and this is your navigator, John Lash, with Nav Briefing number 26, the title being Beauty Breaks Through. Now, that former briefing was done on the 9th of September, so I see now it's almost 2 weeks later. The time has passed in a proverbial blur with an unusual stream of activities in the life of your nav, and that, of course, would be due to the inauguration of Ambergain House. So if you're on the crew list, or if you've checked on metahistory.org lately, you would have seen the announcement of a treasure house for planetary tantra and a land base for the Gaian Navigation Experiment. That announcement comes at a timely moment, which is exactly midway through the initial conditions of corrections. We have 18 months or 5 seconds of Sophia's time behind us, and 18 months ahead. There are many things that I could say at this fulcrum of time. What I would like to do, what is my intention in this current nav briefing, is to kind of review some of the anticipations that were set up at the beginning of this experiment, and to consider how those anticipations have been met. As I've said before, those of you in the Gaia Navigation Experiment know what others will later learn. What I'm going to say now is, of course, relevant to the current moment of the experiment. This is true of all my briefings. They occur in real time, and they reflect the navigational, astronomical, existential and historical conditions of the moment. That does not mean, however, that someone listening to this briefing 1 month or 10 months or 2 years from now cannot benefit from its content. The content of these briefings is not limited by the time frame in which they are delivered. So I would say to those who pick up this briefing in the future, you would be wise to come to understand one of the methodological principles of the Gaian Navigation Experiment that would allow you to know how the founding members of the experiment conducted it, and also would provide you with a method that you might be able to apply in your own life and in your so-called personal reality in one way or another. This is the method of anticipation. Now, anticipation is not prediction. As the navigator of the GNE, and more so as the Turton of the Terma of Gaia Awakening, I do not predict. Prediction is a con game generally employed by people who want to make their mark and who want to become famous if their predictions come true, which they generally don't. Prediction is not a particularly valuable form of human cognitive apprehension. But anticipation is. What does anticipation mean specifically in the frame of the Gaian Navigation Experiment? Well, it's simple. Just put yourself on a sailboat. Say that you're on a small sailboat with a couple of friends, and you're sailing around and among some islands in the Caribbean. You have a map that shows you the lagoons, the shoals, the dangerous rocks, that shows you the lovely islands and the bays where you can harbor. And yet, even though you have a map, the conditions of sailing are always current, and there are many things that arise that cannot be foreseen. So you can anticipate taking your sailboat around a certain point of land, perhaps toward the end of the day, tomorrow. You can't anticipate that, but that may not happen. It's a reliable and it's a reliable anticipation if it's based on an accurate reading of the charts and the winds and the tides. But it's not an absolute prediction of where you will be at noon tomorrow on your sailing adventure. So that is what it means to anticipate. It means to look forward to something that might well come true, consistent with the conditions of the course you're charting, but does not necessarily come true. So there is always a follow-up to anticipation, and this also is an intrinsic aspect of our method, our navigational method. We anticipate things to come, we in the crew, and then later on, based on the timing provided by the navigator, that is to say the timing based on the reading of celestial factors, we ask ourselves the simple question, did that which we anticipated come to pass? And if so, how did it come to pass? And if not, perhaps, why did it not come to pass? So this is a really simple methodology of operating within the parameters of your own experience. And so what I'm going to do now is recall to the GNE crew and anyone else who cares to listen some of the things that we anticipated at the beginning of this experiment in the summer of 2011. And then I'm going to follow that up by considering if those anticipations have been realized. Or to be a little more precise, if and how those anticipations have been realized. Now, the anticipations that arose in charting the course of this experiment over a year ago fall into a range. And over this range, there is a general sort of anticipation that frames the entire set of possibilities that may emerge. Initially, last year, I set up the general frame of anticipation in this way. I said that in the period of 3 years, during the initialization of Sophia's correction, that we could anticipate mainly, we could anticipate events and developments, inner and outer, mainly on two fronts or in two categories. The first category would be the anticipated events or changes in our human reality on this planet that are implemented through the power of the wisdom goddess herself. That which she undertakes independently, and in fact that which only she can do and which human beings cannot do. What human beings cannot achieve collectively out of their own powers, and what even empowered individuals may not achieve, she achieves for us. And that is the first category of the things we anticipate. What does the Divine Sophia achieve in a reality change for the human species during these 3 years? The second category is obviously that which involves us, and what can we achieve and how can we achieve it? And of course, the primary focus of the second category is the GNE itself. It is not really possible to achieve at an optimal level and in anything but a groping and semi-ignorant manner to achieve results consistent with correction if you don't know what correction is. So if you don't have the story, if you don't have the plot as a human individual, you're not going to be achieving any of the anticipated changes in your personal reality and in your interface with the world that become possible during this period. I would add, however, an important qualification here. You know, one thing I want to say to people listening to me currently and to future generations is that John Lash always took the risk that certain things that he said about certain esoteric and mystical subjects would be taken wrongly due to the way that he stated those propositions. This is the Turton's perennial dilemma. The Turton lives between D&D, between discovery and delivery. And both discovery and delivery are, of course, the paramount responsibilities of a Turton or treasure finder. So I discover treasures. I've discovered quite a few of them, and they're going to be on display and available for transmission or turnover at Ambergain House. But in addition to discovering treasures, I'm also faced with the question of how to deliver those treasures. And my delivery is not infallible and certainly not perfect. And I have made many mistakes in my delivery. I make far less mistakes now, but I still make mistakes. And I learn from the mistakes that I make. But when I speak in a certain manner about some topics, specifically two topics, I'm not making a mistake in my delivery by taking a risk. I know exactly what I'm doing. And I take the risk as a way of testing listeners. I'm completely transparent about what I do. I have nothing to hide. I will even reveal my technique to pretty much anyone who cares to listen and who's capable of comprehending it. So I use the technique of saying certain things in a risky or intimidating way, because then I can read from the response how to proceed on a case-by-case basis. The two topics in question here are the topic of the attainment of the Holy Grail, which is the direct encounter with the organic light, and the nature of the Gaia Navigation Experiment itself, specifically the engagement of living in her story. So, the attainment of the Grail and the engagement of living in her story are two propositions that I make always, or almost always, taking an intentional risk that people will be put off or offended by the way that I state them. I know that. And that's how I test people. What precisely is the risk that I take due to my chosen manner of delivery on these subjects, these two supremely rich and engaging subjects? I take the risk that I will be regarded as someone who has a rigid, totalitarian, or exclusionist point of view. For instance, when I say that the attainment of the Holy Grail means many things and it means only one thing, well, in that odd syntax, I am simply paraphrasing exactly a proposition that you can find in the existing alchemical literature. And when I say that, I emphasize the second part, that it is only one thing. And I take the risk that people will be put off by that exclusionist or exclusional emphasis. Likewise, I just made such an exclusional proposition in talking about what we anticipate in the Gaian navigation experiment. I said that you, who undertakes the adventure of a reality change at this critical moment in human history, cannot achieve the optimal and ultimate dimension of that change unless you do it in the framework of her story. That's an exclusional proposition, isn't it? I could be very easily read by a number of listeners as talking like a cult leader and trying to brainwash people into the very narrow mindset which I define for them. I know that, and I take that risk. So just bear in mind that it's a matter of complete personal indifference to me, and even transpersonal indifference, if I might coin a phrase, whether you like these propositions or not. These propositions are highly sophisticated tools of sacred instruction, period. And I use them to the best of my ability, and I enjoy using them. And so if you would enjoy using them as well, then happy day for you, and we can all sail on together in this experiment with the Wisdom Goddess as the mothership and the captain of the ship. So with that little digression, let me return to more specific indications about the range of anticipations set up at the beginning of this experiment. In regard to anticipations of what the Wisdom Goddess herself is doing to initialize her correction, I pointed out that she takes down the archontic infrastructures of the, quote, prison planet, of the, quote, matrix, and of the mind control system that has been installed through humanity's captivation by archontic powers for untold centuries. Only the Aeon Sophia herself can disintegrate that infrastructure. Only she has the power to do so in the limited time available. It would take too long for human beings to deconstruct and dismantle the archontic infrastructure of their own minds and its permeation into the collective cultural matrix for that activity to be fruitful. It would take simply too long. The archontic matrix has to be brought down by the power of the Wisdom Goddess herself. And as I've mentioned a number of times, and I'd like to say this again because it feels good to pronounce these words, the Divine Sophia can do anything she wants with the archons and even with the archontic celestial mechanics of the solar system. She could scrap it in a heartbeat if she wanted to. It's only due to her lending to the archons certain aeonic powers of design that she lends to this inorganic cyborg species, so that they'll go off and amuse themselves and play over on the sidelines to get out of her hair. This is one of the reasons why she gave them the power to create the archontic stereoma that we call the solar system, the planetary system, properly speaking. And just as she allowed them to dupe themselves into believing that they were creator gods operating out of their own powers, she can take that power away from them and she's indeed doing so as I speak. So what we were anticipating in regard to that activity of the planetary animal mother was the breakup of a number of massive, massive delusional archontic systems of error that had been deeply encrusted in the human psyche. You know, I pointed out years ago that back at the time of the Marian conference, when I spoke with Elaine Pagels, in fact, I pointed this out. At that time, when I was just barely at the point of introducing discourse about the archontic powers, which has now become pandemic on the internet, as you may have noticed, at that point in just introducing it, I did my level best to do so in a clear and cogent fashion. So in the initial conditions of revealing the power of the archons to that group of people at that conference and subsequently to other people through metahistory.org, I framed a proposition which is as good today as it was then. And that proposition goes like this. The human mind and behavior become entrained to the power of the archons when humans make errors that go uncorrected and extrapolate beyond the scale of correction. The divine Sophia endowed us with powerful self-correcting faculties. And when we fail to use those faculties to detect the errors in our thinking and in our view of the world and in our view of our relations to each other, and we allow those errors to compound, they develop beyond the scale of correction. And the archons not only induce us into the blindness that takes our errors beyond the scale of correction, but they lavishly exploit that process. And in fact, their power is, we give them power, this is true, but we give them power by our blindness and ignorance and denial, all that is entailed by not looking at our own errors. And by the way, in case you're wondering, the best place to start looking for your errors is in your view of other people around you, other individuals, and in the personal interface, because there are very, very many errors in how we see each other due to the phenomena known as projection. So you can see that there is an exponential slide, the proverbial slippery slope, where the archons gain more and more power over the human mind, but only because we unwittingly grant them that power by the failure to detect and correct our own errors. So, that process of the compounding of errors and of our selective ignorance, as you were, the practice of oblivion in the human species runs very deep. Due to all that, there's a massive encumbrance of error that can only be overcome by the divine Sophia herself. Now, where would we look to see that happening? How did we anticipate it initially? And where would we look to see that happening? Well, let's return to an old cliche that I haven't used for years that comes out of anthroposophy, I think. It's the trinity of science, art, and religion. So let's say that there are massive archontic systems of error and encumberment in these three fields, in science, in art, and in religion. And in this experiment, we, the participants, anticipate those structures coming down, those structures collapsing and falling apart due to the intention of the wisdom goddess herself. So how can we see this? Have these anticipations proven to be true? Starting out with science first, what are the archontic structures of science that need to fall away before a new and refreshing type of science can emerge, a science that is voracious, a science that is based on observation and that is actually actionable in terms of human uses for beneficial purposes and for the making of a better world? Well, since at least the beginning of the 19th century, around the time of the introduction of thermodynamics by Sadi Carnot, positivism of Comte and so forth, that whole period, and well into the beginning years of the 20th century, what we have seen in science is the dominance and inculcation of a massive system of lies and basically fraud. Scientific fraud. There is such a thing as scientific fraud, and it has been enforced rigorously since the time of Faraday and Maxwell, basically. At that time, there was a possibility, and even going back a little earlier, if we go to Mesmer, there was a breakthrough in the Western concept of science, in the Western field of science investigation, that if it had been followed through and left free to develop, could have led to a really enlightened science of plasma and of bioelectrical and bioenergetic phenomenon in which the human animal is intimately implicated. But that whole progression from Mesmer, Faraday, and Maxwell was intentionally and deliberately sabotaged. And in place of the science, the genuine science that we might have had on this planet, we got scientific fraud. And scientific fraud includes everyone, centrally Albert Einstein, centrally Max Planck. Quantum theory is scientific fraud. It accounts for nothing. It's not even useful as a metaphor. You will notice regarding quantum theory that I don't ever quote quantum theory or refer to it as a metaphor in regard to teaching planetary tantra or the Gaia navigation experiment. It's even totally useless as a metaphor. As a metaphor, it is wrong. The idea of a quantum leap of consciousness is wrong. Quantum mechanics is entirely useless, except perhaps as it serves the archons in allowing them to develop arcane algorithms for finance and arcane algorithms for the construction of computer technologies. It serves the satanic, if I might venture to use that term. The satanic meaning everything that is adversarial to true human potential. Not that there is a Satan entity who exists, but there is a satanic tendency working against human potential and against the Anthropos. And quantum physics is only useful for that. It is not even useful as a metaphor of liberation. Einsteinian theory is a hopeless mass of mathematical smoke and mirrors and totally unverifiable, delusional bullshit. If you go on to YouTube and you type in Einstein was wrong, you'll find a number of very clear lectures and talks given which explain point by point how Einstein was wrong and how the evidence has been fudged, or it would be more correct to say the lack of evidence has been fudged, and that no theory of Einstein has ever been observationally or scientifically confirmed, and yet we continue to live in the fraud which elevates Einstein to nothing less than the greatest scientific genius of our time. Nothing could be further from the truth, you know. Take a look at Hedy Lamarr if you want to understand what is a real scientific genius. Yeah, Hedy Lamarr, the actress. So what we find collapsing now, I told you that we can anticipate the collapse of the existing scientific paradigms of relativity theory, both special and general, and quantum mechanics, and string theory, and blah, blah, blah. I mean, string theory is for science what Andy Warhol's tomato can paintings are for art. String theory is completely useless, even as a metaphor. Oh, no, I can hear your objections now. Oh, no, you're going to say string theory is really, string means sequences of resonance, that the universe is composed of sequences of resonances. That's what string theory says. And hey, John, hold on there. Hang on to your britches, man. Isn't that exactly what Hindu Tantra says? Hindu tantric cosmology says that the universe is generated from sound, shabda, and from sequences of resonances, which are described systematically as the 50 signature resonances of the original 50 letters of the Sanskrit alphabet. Well, you know, you can make that argument. But the point with that argument is that it validates string theory, it legitimates string theory by reference to an ancient tried and tested cosmology of Hindu Tantra. Whereas if you just go straight to Hindu Tantra, you don't need string theory, and it becomes an extraneous intellectual game. String theory has gone down. Einsteinian relativity has been proven to be a fraud in a way that a 16-year-old science student in high school can understand. And what can be seen now is that in the growing discourse, which of course is coming out of the marginal areas of society, it's not yet coming out of the center of scientific discourse, which is still locked in the academic bind of scientific fraud that was established over 150 years ago. And by the maintenance of that fraud, people keep their jobs and they keep their positions in academia, but it's crumbling. It's crumbling. And one of the signs of crumbling is that the crumbling of these archontic paradigms doesn't happen insofar as she achieves it for us. Doesn't happen by a battle. It happens by the natural superiority of obvious common sense and the application of human intelligence to nature. It's just so obvious. It's no contest, as Plotinus said about sacred knowledge, and I quote this and not in his image. It's of no contest. There's no contest between the self-evident veracity of Reichian physics, Reichian biophysics, or plasma cosmology and plasma theory, electric universe theory. There's no contest between that science and the fraud of Einsteinian relativity and quantum physics. And so she makes it easy in a way. All that is required is that human beings turn their attention to the beauty and the self-evidential quality of what we really can know about the universe, starting with the evidence of our own senses. Turn your mind in that direction, and she has cleared the field. She is clearing the field. And so we see the evident absurdity and fraudulence of these massive errors exposed more and more all the time. And what goes down, as well as Einsteinian theory, Gravitational waves, complete nonsense. Black holes, ridiculous. I was telling people 35 years ago in Santa Fe, a black hole is just a mathematical fiction. Black holes were invented to explain the inexplicable. Now, when the Nahual, like me, who has the disease of explaining, explains the inexplicable, if I do it correctly, it's going to give you a bit of a thrill. But when scientists invent specious concepts and mathematical formulas to explain the inexplicable, it does nothing but deaden and stultify the human mind. Quasars and pulsars are mathematical fictions that were invented to explain the inexplicable emissions of synchrotronic radiation from the Crab Nebula. And you can go back and research it. That is a fact. It all goes back to the Crab Nebula. A great part of the content of scientific fraud today in astrophysics and astronomy is an attempt to explain what is happening in the Crab Nebula. Dark matter, complete bullshit. Forget about it. There is no such thing as dark matter. Go and look at the reason why the concept of dark matter was introduced. And you'll find that it was because scientists detected through their investigations into gravitational mass, which is in itself a highly dubious concept, that there was more mass present in the universe, more mass slash matter present than could be explained by what is visible. And so they postulated the idea of invisible mass or dark matter. And they needed that concept, which is a totally specious concept that cannot be verified or observed and never will be, they needed that in order to dupe themselves about their own ignorance. And I will say to all the scientists who still hold to the idea of dark matter that I have the answer to the question that they couldn't answer. They were wondering how the universe can be materially cohesive and materially coherent on its material dynamics when the matter that is absolute, that is actually observable, is far less than would be required for that coherence. Okay, my scientific friends, my astronomers and astrophysicists out there, get ready for this. I'll tell you what is the factor of coherence that you falsely postulate in a dark matter hypothesis. It's not the existence of a mysterious dark matter that causes the whole universe to cohere in the way that it does. It's the existence of glue. Glue. And what is that glue at the basis of the cohesion of the universe? It is your fucking stupidity. So just take that on board. Now allow me to move on to another aspect of the breakthrough in the scientific paradigm, and then I'll cover art and religion. As the world sees the delusional and fraudulent paradigms of science fall away, we, of course, want a new science to emerge. And as I've indicated, and even did indicate when I wrote Not in His Image, we want to look to plasma cosmology and the electric universe theory for the rude lineaments of this new science. Now, I think it's remarkable that plasma cosmology is coming into definition sharply and dramatically in these 3 years of the initialization of correction. And I would like very much to do an individual briefing, dedicate a single briefing to plasma cosmology and talk about it. And I would also enjoy being in dialogue with some plasma cosmologists. They may or may not be interested in my observations that their paradigm, the next paradigm, is getting off to a shaky start. And I would advise them to look very closely at the initial conditions in which they set up this new science. Now, you know, in Kali Yuga, there's a principle known to Kalikas, and that is that any situation, any event, can be mastered if it is put into the metaphor of gaming. This is not some incidental or trivial proposition, I assure you. Perhaps I can apply it and demonstrate it for you right now briefly by saying that the plasma cosmologists so far have made some brilliant moves. They've played some good cards, and they've laid down some winning hands. But they do not yet know the rules of the game. They haven't defined the rules of the very game in which they look to be in a winning position. And it's extremely important that in the next year or two that they get plasma cosmology up and running on the right premises, and that they know the game they're playing and the hands that are being dealt to them and the hands they are playing in this game. In particular, I mentioned before, although the interface between mythology and mythological imagery, as recorded in indigenous art, in petroglyphs and cave paintings and so forth, although the interface between this mythological imagery and the behavior of plasmas is a brilliant observation, I don't know where the plasma cosmologists are getting their mythological advice, but they're certainly not getting the advice they need. One of their prominent speakers made the comment that when we look at the body of world mythology, we see that the powers of the earth and the telluric goddess or earth goddess have always been represented consistently by correlation to a particular planet. And guess what planet that might be? Well, some of you might think it's the Earth, but he said it was Venus. So you see, this is like a really, really serious error in the stellar mythology component of plasma cosmology. And it's not the only error they're making. They're getting off to a shaky start, playing brilliant hands without understanding what card game they're actually in so far. So I propose that it might be a project associated with the tasking of the GNE to link up the NAV with some of the people in the Thunderbolts project so we can have a little discourse about these matters. Then I would see in a short period of time if they're receptive to looking at things and self-correcting in any instance in which self-correction would be appropriate. Another aspect of science where the archontic matrix of error and delusion is breaking down, which is a more difficult area, however, would be, of course, in chemistry, biochemistry, and pharmaceutics. I would keep a close eye on the people who are arguing that AIDS is a fraudulent, AIDS is a con, and that there is no such thing as AIDS. And if you haven't looked at that, there are, again, a couple of very valuable documentaries to this effect. AIDS would be a great place for medical fraud to break down because it's such a charged issue. The battle goes on with the attempt of the psychopaths to completely control access not only to psychoactive plants or the sacred medicine allies provided by Gaia, but also to basic vitamins and minerals. And this is a battleground. It's not an easy battle, but because there is this massive legislation directed against the obvious and healthy and salubrious products of nature that the earth provides for us. But this is an area, a front line, where we might anticipate even further breakdowns, but we really need a breakthrough in that area. And so far, I haven't seen that happen yet. There needs to be a massive breakthrough so that the archontic lies that support GMOs and the whole transhumanist agenda looks as silly and evil as it actually is. And it still doesn't look that way to enough people. And it doesn't look that way dramatically enough for even a few people to realize the absolute requirement to get beyond that system, to take down that system, and to move back to natural healing. So that's a problematical area in the realm of science. I won't say that this briefing is comprehensive to all the areas where anticipations have been formed, but I'm just covering what I have in some short notes that I've made here. Now let's jump from art, which is a dicey subject, to religion for a moment. Well, what is the sign that the religious paradigms are breaking down? Well, there's a lot. The Catholic Church is in a great deal of trouble. The accusations and the evidence for quote, satanic slash pedophile network are growing all the time. There are people in Canada and elsewhere, I believe, who are seriously and systematically pursuing legal action against the Queen of England and the Catholic Church. Want to keep your eye on Italy, of course. Not in His Image is coming out in an Italian translation at the end of this year. The publishing date is December 21st. The paradigm of salvationist religion has been under enormous stress, of course, for some time now. I would say that we're about halfway there in the complete and total breakdown and discrediting of the con of salvationist religion, with Catholicism, Roman Catholicism at the top, and all the other varieties falling like dominoes. However, we might anticipate one crucial event in the next 18 months that would really bring the house down in that respect. The other area where I see evidence of a massive breakdown of the archonic matrix in religion, of the false paradigm, concerns the subject of what I have quaintly named Jumanity. And the problem of Jumanity is a serious one, as you may know. And question of what it means to be Jewish is something that I am now prepared to discuss. And that topic is a focus of mine right now. And you can expect or anticipate some talks on that soon, although I'm not exactly sure where to put out these talks and how to get them into circulation. I do want to say, though, that I see a remarkable shift very recently, and perhaps could be considered signaled, the signal of this shift, the flare, would be the publication of a book called The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. I think the author of this book is Preston. Anyway, the book is available in published form and also on the internet. Now, as you all certainly know, whether you're crew members or not, it's a very dicey thing to deny the Holocaust. And here in Europe, there's a number of countries where you can be thrown into prison for doing so, and people have been imprisoned. That, of course, in itself ought to raise some very serious suspicions. I mean, can you think of anything else? And suppose I denied, you know, some other event happened in history. Suppose I denied that the potato famine ever happened in Ireland, you know. Would I be thrown into prison for publicly arguing that the potato famine never happened, you know? Or that the Armenian genocide never happened, you know? So it seems odd that there is one subject, a paramount subject, in recent history, upon which one cannot pronounce an alternative view without fear of imprisonment. Now, I'm not afraid of this, because what I have to say about the Holocaust hoax is genial and amicable and friendly, and even, if I might not take the risk of exaggerating, even compassionate toward posages, that is to say, people of self-assumed Jewish identity. So I have no beef with these people. I don't have an axe to grind with people who call themselves Jewish. But I would like to point out to them the danger of joining a club when you don't know the rules and bylaws of that club. So eventually I will do that, but what I want to point out right now is something that I consider to be striking evidence of the massive breakdown of the archontic lie of religion. You know, I want you to picture standing in front of a dam, like the Grand Coulee Dam or the Hoover Dam of that dammed up the Colorado River. You know, you can visualize how massive that is. Imagine you're just a little human being the size of an ant. You're standing down there looking up at this massive concrete wall, which is in kind of a concave shape, I believe. And behind that is a massive volume of water of the Colorado River. And you're looking at this dam. And then as you look closely, you detect that there are cracks in the dam. In fact, there's a whole network of cracks. It's cracking all across the surface, all across the concrete surface of this dam, with a massive network of cracks appearing. And of course, that's really interesting, because you're wondering, you know, when it's going to give. And as you continue to observe this crack up of the dam, let's say that you notice that in the construction of the dam, in the way that it was constructed, as the crack up occurs and as the dam begins to vibrate from the force of the water that wants to burst through it, you notice that you can see the infrastructure of the dam, and you can see the main braces and bulwarks upon which the massive face of the dam was constructed. And so even though the dam is breaking everywhere, that the concrete is showing fractures all over the place, your attention is drawn to the main seam or bulwark of the dam. Because when the main seam goes, that's when the dam massively goes. Now keep that analogy in mind and turning back to this question of the ultimate and final and supreme breakdown of the archontic religious lie. The archontic religious lie is like a dam, like a Hoover Dam that stands in the way of the pouring forth of the sublime and divine power of human imagination in every single person endowed with that power. It is what holds back the divine endowment of the Anthropos and wants to turn it into a force that there runs turbines for a satanic program that works against humanity. And in that massive damming up of human potential and blocking and impeding and suppressing of the erotic and imaginative power of the human animal, there are particular seams. In fact, there is one main seam or one main internal bulwark of the religious lie, and that is the story of humanity, which is master race theory. Master race theory originated with the Zadokim cult of the ancient Hebrews. It's not that old, and even if it is older, you don't have to go back any further. The initial conditions of it in historical time are all you need to know about. It's a shaggy dog story and a red ice type of massive digression to go back into the rabbit hole to look for the ultimate root of this story. It's sufficient to know that the root can be traced forward from the Zadokim cult. That is the origin of theocracy enforced by a master race theory enshrined in the ethnic identity of a certain group of people. And this is the problem that stands as the main seam in the great lie of religion. Now, some of you may not know that the story that Jews and other people who were kept in internment camps, they weren't extermination camps or concentration camps, get the language straight here, that Jews and some other people, such as gypsies, political dissidents, were kept in internment camps, were systematically and massively exterminated in gas chambers. Some of you may not know where that story originated. Now, I suggest that you go and find out, and you look into the testimony of the Nuremberg trials and to Rudolf Hess, who was tortured and who faced the threat that his family and children would be murdered if he did not confess certain things about what happened in the so-called death camps. So go and investigate where the gas chamber story came from, and then also go and investigate what were the gassing booths that were used to defumigate clothing and bedding from the deadly disease of typhus, which accounted for a lot of the deaths in the internment camps in World War II. And to go and look into these matters. I'm sure that all these matters are discussed in this book, The Holocaust Hoax Exposed. What I see as a turning point now is that the attempt to bring to public attention and to the minds of reasonable people an alternative scenario of what actually happened to the Jewish people in Second World War is now hugely improved and becomes easy. It becomes, there are things now working to the advantage of people who would not deny the Holocaust. It's not a question of denying. Even the idea of Holocaust denial is a straw man propagandist ploy. No one denies that people died massively. But those who investigate the Holocaust are saying, what is the evidence of how it actually occurred and how it was done and what they actually died from? So this so-called historical revisionism, which means just going back and looking at the events and looking at the actual evidence, now gains an advantage. And it becomes more and more acceptable to do this. It becomes more and more acceptable to see the obvious. And more acceptable, more and more possible, I would say, to see the massive fabrication of lies and pretending that has been constructed around the actual events that took place. I do not deny, nor do any other rational and sober revisionist deny, that people died in the German internment camps. What is in question is how many people died and how, and what were the actual conditions in those camps. And so the moment has come, I think, for the main seam or bulwark of the great religious lie to break. And when that main seam breaks, the whole dam collapses. And I would identify that main seam as the official Jewish-supported version of the so-called Holocaust. Just imagine what would happen in the imaginations of even ordinary people. No, I just say, just try to conceive what would happen in the minds and imaginations of ordinary people if it suddenly dawned on them that the received and widely promulgated Holocaust story is a total fabrication. Can you conceive of how liberating that would be? And what a relief it would be. And my sense is that this is right around the bend, and that this event, where the dam breaks right along the main seam, could be anticipated in the second half of correction. And I say that with complete spirit of goodwill toward Jewish people. Nothing against them. They're human beings like anyone else, even though they might not consider that to be so. I do consider them to be human beings first, before any ethnic or religious labels are attached. And so I speak as one human animal to the other human animals who would call themselves Jewish and ask them if they would like to be liberated from a massive lie along with the rest of non-Jewish humanity or not. And this proposition, this argument, comes dramatically to the forefront in the second half of correction. So that brings us down almost to the end of this briefing. I think I'll actually end it here and continue in the next briefing under the same title. I'll call it Beauty Breaks Through Part 2, and I'll continue with these reflections and then come around to the subject of beauty itself, which is the most massive element in the liberating power of the wisdom goddess. Beauty is our weapon. Beauty is her weapon. Truth is beauty, and truth is beautiful. Lies, fraud, and deception are ugly, and they make ugly the people who promulgate them and the people who embrace them. So ultimately, the breakthrough that we anticipate in correction is the breakthrough, is a breakthrough of beauty in ourselves and around ourselves. And on that note, I just want to close very briefly with a dream I had about 3 nights ago. I dreamt that I was standing realistically on the terrace of the Turton's house, I believe, and it was pre-dawn, the sky was pitch black, and the stars were shining like diamonds. And I was observing the celestial anchor rise over the eastern horizon. And every single component of the anchor in the dream was exactly as it appears in real life. So I could see the Pleiades at the top. I could see the crossbar of the beam with Jupiter at the center. And Jupiter is now almost has moved subtly, so it's almost exactly at the center between Aldebaran and Elnat. Then I could see the long vertical stem of the anchor and the massive, majestic arms of the lower part, the lower armature of the anchor with the two hooks that are the grounding mechanism formed by Castor and Pollux on the left and Sirius and Mizam on the right. And it was all just exactly as I've seen it for night after night now, except that in this dream, there was something else. In that area of the celestial anchor, below the upper armature and above the lower armature, that is to say, in that entire section of the long vertical stem, was a massive cloud of organic light. Now, when you know what organic light looks like, the organic light, you recognize it when you see it. And I was standing there speechless because here was the celestial anchor, just as some of you are viewing it now. But at the same moment, significantly placed without obscuring any of the identifying stars, was this massive field, like a pond with ruffled edges, this massive field of pearly, luminous organic light. Now that organic light, when you see it, is living beauty. It is divine power, divine knowledge, manifesting as beauty, and as Kundry famously noted one time when we were observing the organic light together here in Andalusia, the beauty is alive. Imagine how you feel when you see something beautiful. Beautiful flower, beautiful dance, beautiful mountain, a waterfall, a glacier calving. Beautiful view of the rainforest. How you feel in the presence of that beauty, and then add to that the feeling that you have, which is electrifying, that the beauty is alive. She's an animal. She's alive. And the very surface of the earth pulses with her life, just like the flank of a great mother lion pulses when she breathes. And so I don't know what to make of that particular dream, and I leave it to you, and I won't impose anything. But I came away from it with that same feeling that I have each time I see the living beauty of the organic light in nature. Beauty is alive, and the life ahead and the life worth living is to be found there in that beauty. And you are in that beauty and of that beauty. So as long as you know that and realize it and retain that realization, you are at the place of the breakthrough. You are the place where beauty breaks through.